Hello everyone, this is Belinda Carr. Welcome back to the Boost AAC podcast, where we dive into the world of construction and explore the stories of people and companies who are shaping the future of our industry. Today, I'm speaking with Jonathan Orpin, founder and CEO of New Energy Works. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thank you. Thanks. It's great to speak with you. So tell us a little bit about your company. I believe you all design, fabricate, and build high-performance timber buildings.
Sure. So we started 30-some years ago as timber framers, and we still, that is really the heart and soul of what we do is heavy timber construction. But over the years, we've added various business units to it, to timber framing. So for instance, we quickly learned that we wanted to be general contractors for a small percentage of what we do, because it keeps us at the edge of the front edge of knowledge and experience, and gives us control over certain projects that might be in our backyard, for instance. And then we added our fine woodworking department called New Woodworks, because our clients are looking for a consistent visual and a consistent performance and delivery system. So we do our own cabinets and stairs and often doors and all that sort of stuff in our fine woodworking.
Speaking of your clients, are you primarily in the residential sector or commercial sector?
So we are probably 80% residential and 20% commercial.
Okay. And most of your clients, are they located? Where are you all located, by the way?
Sure. Right now I'm sitting in Portland, Oregon, where I moved out here 15 years ago when the company in New York had grown to about 85 people. And I realized that I wanted to be a little bit more on the front line, so to speak, talking to clients instead of managing people. You know, it's a classic entrepreneurial thing. I just needed to spread my wings a little bit. So the New York operation has grown to probably about 100, 110 people. And we have maybe 50 to 60 people out here in New York.
And your projects are spread over the Northeast and then the Northwest as well?
So we've built in 46, I think, of the 50 states and a couple countries besides. And the countries that come to mind, I believe, are England and, of course, Canada. So we pretty much work everywhere. If it's west of the Mississippi, we take it here at in the Oregon shop. And if it's east of the Mississippi, we take it in a New York shop.
So what do y'all specialize in? And we touch upon how y'all primarily build with timber, but what sets your company apart from the other timber manufacturers out there?
I think there's a lot of really good timber framers out there. There's not too many who are integrated the way we are. In fact, none that come to mind that are as integrated. We're a full architectural firm. We, as I mentioned before, we do the whole enclosure. I didn't actually mention it before you sort of went off in a different topic before I finished about our company. We added high-performance enclosures, which we call HPEZ, or High Performance Made Easier. And then we added Pioneer Millworks, which is reclaimed and sustainably harvested wood products like siding and flooring and paneling and that sort of thing. So we're all sorts of things, a bit chaotic, I might add, but what it is the core to who we are is wood and the triple bottom line of looking at a business through the lens of people, planet, and profit.
Oh, that's so a lot that's a lot of topics we're going to cover. So let's talk about the wood aspect of it first and then move on to the triple bottom line. There are a lot of misconceptions about building with wood out there, which is frustrating and it's also disappointing, but it's a good opportunity to clear up all these misconceptions. Wood is a sustainable resource, and if you harvest it sustainably, it is a far better building material for residential buildings, especially than steel or concrete.
Yeah, you bet. From a sustainability perspective, there's no question about that. A tree grows, the amount of carbon footprint, so to speak, or the energy, embodied energy or the energy that it takes to bring it to market is, who knows, hundreds, maybe thousands of times less than some of your high needs, like, for instance, concrete or steel. And so it's the most important solution we have. You know, there's just, it's not even a debate, honestly. So So I'm not sure about the misconceptions you're referring to, but I'd happily tackle them all. And if we can, in the next half hour, kill all the misconceptions about wood, let's do it.
Well, I actually released this video a while back on container homes because everyone, it was being pitched as the most sustainable tiny home solution out there. And I was talking about the carbon footprint of steel as opposed to wood. And the first thing that people who aren't in the AEC industry think when you cut down a tree, it's bad for the planet. Using steel is far better than that. So that those are the kind of misconceptions I was referring to.
So the whole container thing, I mean, I think that came and gone by now, isn't it?
It feels like it makes a comeback every couple of years.
Sure. And it's fun. You know, we store things in old containers ourselves at our business, but I wouldn't want to live in one. You know, who wants to live in something that doesn't breathe? And by the time you cut out all the holes and you insulate it and all the other stuff, it's, well, anyway, we don't need to go there. But steel itself, there's just no possible way that you can compare what it takes to make steel, to transport steel, to mine the ores required for steel, you know, against wood and wood products. There's just no way. Now, there is a good conversation to be had about well-harvested forest and good forestry and logging practices compared to ungood.
Unregulated, less, yes.
Let's just say less good. So, for instance, we're FSC or Forest Stewardship Council certified with chain of custody command. I mean chain of custody certification, as well as a reasonable percentage of our wood comes from FSC certified forests. And I can circle back on that. Our goal is to become 100% before too long. There are some supply chain and other financial impediments to that, but we're breaking those down. And then our larch, for instance, as an example, that we use for a lot of our siding products, that comes from PEFC certified forest in Canada. PEFC stands for, and I never get this perfectly right because it's a bit European, but it's Program for Environmental Forest Conservation. That's a European standard more than it is. And so the Canadians who sell a lot to Europe are often PEFC as opposed to FSC certified, though both are important. They're third-party independent certification systems, and they're both rigorous. Unlike the, you know, SFI, which is Sustainable Forestry Initiative, which is more of a industry-based initiative. Which is better than nothing, but Nothing's a pretty low bar.
That's very true. So talk about the wood that you all source. You all source it from a different third-party suppliers that log it from different parts of the country and even from Canada as well?
Yes.
Okay. And so you all don't, do you all just do any CNC routing and final finishing, but you all don't actually do the processing of the lumber in-house, right?
Yeah, so... Glenda, we're timber framers, which means we start with big timbers. Those big timbers come to us rough sawn from a sawmill or a kiln. For instance, in our case, almost all our wood is kiln dried. So we're buying from sawmills, which buys from the sawmill. And then it comes to us as a rough sawn 8x8 or 8x10, whatever it is. And then from there, we plane it and we do use CNC equipment on both our coasts to do much of the joinery, but then we finish it off by hand, oil it, and then we carry it out and raise the timber frame at some site. You know, usually it's a gorgeous site, and it's always a sunny day when we do this. So,
always, you know, perfect conditions, yeah.
Always perfect conditions. It's the best day of the world, the best day of the year when you've got a raised naked timber frame against a blue sky and drinking beer with the people who just hired us to do that work.
Well, you all have some pretty gorgeous images on your website of all the homes and commercial buildings you all have constructed. There's this, the buildings that you all built are not, you all really celebrate the timber that you have that's been used to construct the building. There's this warm, homey feeling, almost like it's from a Hallmark movie or something. It's a beauty to it from the outside, and even when you walk through the space, it's a beautifully executed building. And do you think part of it is because you said, like, you have architects and interior designers in-house. Y'all are almost like vertically integrated. So they understand how to use your product, how the product is going to be executed by your building team?
Yes and no. I would say it's critical that we do have internal design teams, but really all of the work that we do, only about 30% of it is designed in-house. The rest is from incredible architects all over the country. And so it's a really nice mix of exterior influences, yeah, interior influences, learning from each other. When an architect comes to us, you know, we know what they're up against. We know what their constraints are. We know what the opportunities are. So even when it's not our design, we're really good. I think it comes out better because we get it. And most of the time, they just come back to us time and time again. And again, I want to make it really clear. There's some really good timber framers in this country. So we're not the only ones.
Yes.
You ought to check out Timber Framers Guild. That's my plug for the industry organization that I have long supported, that New Energy Works has long been a super supporter of. So the Timber Framers Guild is a great place. And there are good timber framers around. We just happen to be one of them. And ours is probably a little more integrated. Maybe we're larger than most, though not the largest by any means.
So let's move on to the triple bottom line that you mentioned earlier. What were the three tenets that you mentioned?
I mentioned people, planet, and profit, or sometimes we call prosperity. For me, business is more than just personal wealth. And in fact, that's we're a 100% employee-owned company. So I'm just the CEO, no longer the owner. And business is really, really important that it become what it really can be, which is really one of the largest and most powerful opportunities for social change or environmental change or all sorts of change that is needed all the time. You know, the world is always reinventing itself. Yeah. And business is a great opportunity. I mean, here's a great example. The triple bottom line cares equally, like three legs of a stool, equally between people. That's the people that are involved in the business. That's the people we work with, our clients. But it's also about our community. And you can name your community anything you want. It could be your church, your school, you know, your extended family. But it's also about the community of people on Earth, right? Which brings us right to the second tenet, which is planet. They got it. You know, we have to have a place to live. It's not, climate change is real. It's not some China hoax, which is some politician once said embarrassingly. It's a real thing. And so businesses have the opportunity to be a big part of the solution. Think about Exxon for a minute. In 1980, they knew that climate change was a real thing and it was a real problem, and they buried that.
Yeah.
Had they taken a different approach and really cared and said, wow, we need to be part of this climate solution instead of just continually making unbelievable gobs of money, then we would not be in the pickle we were in. We would not be there. And then, of course, profit. You need to have profit to run a business. You know, for us, profit is a critical fuel to run our engine. We can't invest in ourselves. We can't invest in getting better. We can't properly pay our people, making sure they have a living wage and proper benefits. So planet, people, planet, and profit make the three even filters or tenants that we operate on. And we didn't invent it. It was really a phrase coined in the mid-1990s. Even though we've been triple bottom line since the 80s, it nonetheless is, I think it's a really good phrase. And I don't remember the guy's name, but you can find it on the web. So triple bottom.
I love that you explained all that so well, but I have this question for you. How do you, as a company, juggle all those tenets that are so important to not just the company, to the world itself, with the reality that construction is long-term and everyone's concerned about upfront costs? How do you build better? How do you build high-performance buildings? How do you build sustainable buildings when the industry has other priorities?
Yeah, so we're just a little company. We're not going to save the world by ourselves. Yeah. I can't answer your question because there is no answer to your question.
Is it just about finding the right clients that share the same values?
I'd like to say it's about inspiring the right clients. properties. So for instance, here's a great example. We use wood fiber insulation as our exterior insulation. And for those of you in trades, you know what I'm talking about, thermal break of the studs. So we use a rigid exterior insulation for years, and we've been doing this since 1993. So for years and years, we used 1.5 inches of polyisocyanurate, which is just, you know, rigid, high R sheathing or the foil face stuff. And about 6-8 years ago, we really started to use a wood fiber rigid insulation. In our case, we call it Steico. It's imported from Germany and Poland, soon to be made here in the U.S. So we started importing it. And one of our first clients was an oil man from Texas. And oil family, you know, his last name is the name of a famous university in Texas. You can figure it out. And it was all oil money. And he himself was a money manager. And it was not an unbelievably big house, but it was a well proportioned house. And we were talking to him, and I said, well, Mr. B, I use rigid wood-based insulation for the exterior. I said, we used to use polyisocyanurate, but we've been working to get away from petroleum products for this, and that's what we do. And then I shut up, because I figured at that point he was going to pick up a chair and hit me with it or something like that. And he thought about it. This is an intelligent man who, you know, is a financial advisor and stuff. And he thought about it for a minute and looked at me and said, that seems like a great idea, John. Carry on. At that point, I knew people were willing, once again, to listen to the environmental issues. And they have been. And people are very interested, but they got to know about it. And so what we do is, to quote an old friend of mine, John Abrams, he said, we like to inspire people to build a little smaller so that they're able to build a little better. And I start all my design meetings that way. I warn people, I'm going to be pushing you to build a little smaller so that you can build a little better. And then I look at the two people, and I say, somebody's got to pay those taxes, and somebody's got to vacuum all that space. And they start to say, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. It's a little smaller, less vacuuming, less taxes. And by the way, it happens to be a lot more comfortable, easy to heat or cool, and good for the planet. So even doesn't really matter what your interest is, all of these things land home in a nice spot. But people need to know about it.
That's true.
Or be inspired. You know, that's what we say. We try to inspire people.
I'm reading this book right now, Pretty Good House. And in the book, they're the same quality, same features that you were talking about, building smaller, building better. It really breaks it down into really simplistic terms, even for people who aren't experts in building science. Explains it in visual and very simple terms. And it's great to hear you speak about that and talk about like inspiring, not just educating, but inspiring your clients to go down that path. We don't all need mansions in our suburban homes if they're all poorly built and leaky homes that have extremely high operational footprints. We can do with less.
So a lot of people say that McMansion.
McMansions, yes.
That's the classic. I also like Starter Castle. I think that's
a new one.
We built some big houses. I'm not, yeah. You know, there's some amazing architects, amazing clients, you know, pays a lot of good bills. We built some big stuff. But one of the things we say is it's better because we were there. So, you know, in a perfect world, maybe we've convinced them to build 10% smaller or certainly 30% better when it comes to the important things, which is the high performance of the envelope, but also the low carbon footprint of the materials. And this is something I hope we can talk about, the carbon sequestration of those materials. You know, one of the things we're trying to do right now is figure out what to do with an overheated planet. And that's because there's too much CO2 in the air and in the atmosphere. And so how do we sequester some of that back? And certainly wood, properly harvested wood, that's a big one.
Yeah.
You know, the use of wood and the use of properly harvested wood, that's a big one.
And what methods do y'all adopt to tackle carbon sequestration?
Yeah, so that's the biggest one. I mean, I got to be honest.
Wood fiber insulation too.
Well, right. Wood timber for the structure, wood for the enclosure, wood fiber insulation. Those are all really great things. I will say that we just poured 200 yards of concrete for a project we're doing. It's a large industrial building, 20,000 square foot, so it's not that large, but an industrial building that we designed to be wood-framed industrial building. Now, here in America, everybody thinks, oh, you have to have steel or tilt-up concrete, both of which are anathema to me when it comes to environmental issues. So we took a European set of glasses and put them on and said, well, what other options are there? So we've got these 90-foot clear span glue lamb trusses, you know, that we're using in this. We are enclosing the building with basically a modified stud wall full of wood fiber insulation. So there's all of that in this building. But interestingly, we also put biochar filler in the concrete mixture, which is really fascinating. So in the, and I'm sorry, I'm going to space out here on exactly how many tons, but I think it was like 30 tons or something worth of carbon that we were able to sequester forever in that concrete slab and footer because we went this way. It's biochar is one of the fillers instead of sand, which does a few things. Because biochar is carbon-based, it actually sequesters it, the carbon. But also, it's nearby. I'm not bringing sand from a long distance to make that concrete. So anyway, it's a pretty cool process. I might suggest that if anybody's interested in that, they look up solidcarbon.com, yep. solidcarbon.com. You know, those folks are friends of mine who started out here in McMinnville where we are. So just coincidentally in the same place. But, you know, that's another area where concrete, which is the second worst offender for the GWP global warming potential after coal burning in the planet, you know, if we can suddenly help make concrete not as bad.
So high performance buildings can cover a lot of different topics. And one of them is passive building or passive house construction. Is that something that you have passive house designers and builders on your staff?
Yeah. So passive house is one of these cutters of the wake. You know, there are people way out in front, started up in Germany in the 1990s and has been adopted by amazing people here in the States. FIES, which is... Yeah. Passive House
Institute of the U.S.
Yeah. I've got friends of mine on the board. I think they've done really good work. And internally, we have we've got six or eight people in the company who are Passive House certified in one way or another, either as designer or builder. And we think it's really, really great. We don't do a lot of actual Passive House certified buildings. We head in that direction. I think that's probably a very common thread. The extra cost to the client means that because they're paying for the passive house certification, they're not going to get the kitchen they want. And that's not, you know, if I can inspire people to build better, I can't inspire them to give up their nice kitchen. So I'm not that good. So, you know, there's that kind of balance there. But also, and this is a little controversial, I think passive house can go too far. To me, the most important thing we can think about is in the build, not in the operational carbon equivalent, carbon cost, environmental cost, we could say. Because I think we've got a horizon that's coming at us closer than the sometimes long-term return on investment of an incredibly well-done passive house structure. Now, it really depends on which climate zone you're in. So out here in Oregon, we're in climate zone 4 most of the time, all the time. And yeah, climate zone 4 is pretty mellow.
Forgiving, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I grew up in Western New York, and again, our New York operation is there. That's climate found 5, we find ourselves in 6. So that's a little bit more, less forgiving, as you say. And so all of these things need to be taken into consideration. But the truth is, I'm much more interested in carbon sequestration, as I mentioned before, in low carbon equivalence when it comes to the build process, than I am in something that's going to give me a, you know, that's going to be incredible 50 years from now. Because I don't know what's going on in 50 50 years, but I know what's going on today and we need to make some changes.
Yeah,
so,
that's an excellent point,
I am seeing a lot of the passive house people sort of shift around. Like it used to be spray-in-place polyurethane foam would solve all their problems. And now they're starting to say, oh, well, we probably shouldn't use that. Well, you know, great. I knew that 30 years ago. I don't, you know, figure it
you're
out.
You're not a proponent of spray foam insulation.
We should not be using spray-in-place polyurethane insulation for anything.
Is it the off-gassing concerns with it?
Or? No. It's the amount of energy it takes to make one R value, so to speak, of that. It's like 13,000 times more than cellulose insulation. You know, you can find that in any chart, in any, you know, just get on the web and you'll say, oh, wow, spray in place closed cell polyurethane foam is really a Dickens. It does do some things well, but it also does some things poorly. Ignore just the carbon footprint for a minute. It also makes a house not breathing very well. And to me, you know, we build open, breathable walls. We just think that's the right way to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is an argument. Now, I'm sure that I'm going to have people knocking on my doors with dark glasses and suits with little guns in their pocket, taking me out. But at least you've heard it before they take me out, Belinda.
It's very interesting to see the experimentation that goes on with all these, I call them new building products, because I toured a spray foam factory here in Dallas about 2 years ago or so, and they were talking about how low the footprint is, how low the energy footprint is to manufacture the product, and how it can build airtight buildings, which in turn can help lower your HVAC bills. So that was their perspective. And then I visited Switzerland just after that, I toured that spray foam factory, and it seems like they have gone past that. They experimented with spray foam, or Europe experimented with spray foam, had a bad experience. Now everyone's against it. And Switzerland was building these massive 12 to 16 inch walls with rock wool on the inside, on the outside. Just, it felt like a little bit of overkill, but they had gone down the path of completely breathable buildings with massive walls to have to go down the path of thermal mass rather than thin walls with using spray foam and have airtight buildings. So it's just really interesting that we try this one thing, doesn't really work, let's try this other thing. And it's I'm not sure, like, there's no silver bullet. Like, there's no one type of insulation that's going to be perfect for all of us, for every single building type and every single climate zone. So I think it's a game we got to play and figure out what's the best for at this particular time, at this particular moment.
That's very politically correct of you to say there's not one thing for everybody. I haven't followed recently, like in the last 6 months. I have heard a number of people claiming that the closed cell polyurethane industry is saying how green they are. And I'm open to listening. Let me say, my information might be 6 months old, but I'm sure that everybody's, I'm not really sure, but I think, and in my best moments, I think that everyone's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But I would be hard-pressed to be convinced of that. I mean, if you go to a concrete construction convention, they'll tell you they're the greenest thing. I'm sorry, I'm just not.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Rockwool itself, again, I'm going to have more people lined up to shoot me in a minute here. I mean, that, I don't get that at all. You know, there's just nothing, that just seems like greenwashing to the max to me.
Yeah.
It's made from basalt rock. It's shipped from Hamilton, Oregon, all over the country. Oregon, I say Hamilton, Ontario, all over the country. And I don't... And it's actually not that easy to use. I mean, I'm not sure what the problem with wood fiber insulation is. It just seems like it's so easy to use and works so great.
So there's a company that's coming up in the States, in Maine, I believe, Timber HP. And they're going to be the first national wood fiber insulation company. I'm hoping that they scale up production and we won't have to import wood fiber insulation from Europe anymore. And I believe y'all bought the first products from them.
We did.
Yeah.
And for full transparency, I was also an early adopter, but also early investor in Timber HP, just because I believe in it. You know, we've been importing Steico, which is like Gutex, but it's another of the wood fiber insulation from Poland and Germany. For 6-8 years at one point, I think we were the largest, we might still be the largest user of Steico in the country. And it's just because it makes all the sense in the world. And so when Maine started talking about it, the Timber HP folks, which is basically really two really forward-thinking people, Matt, an architect, and Josh, a chemist, started thinking about it. They were thinking big. And so they've now been shipping their first batches of loose fill, which, as you pointed out, we bought the first truckload, our claim to fame, I guess. And they'll soon be shipping, I think maybe this week, they're finally getting the bats. Mm-hmm. Online. They've been working on it for 4 months. And apparently it's not as easy as I never thought it was. So, And then a few months after that, they hope to get the rigid boarding.
Yeah.
So, and that's in Maine. I'm in Oregon. Darn. But the good news is after they can get the cash flow going again and really moving, the plan is to build a West Coast plant for plant number two. We think that's probably 3-4 years out. It's hard to know. This stuff, shockingly, you cannot snap your fingers and suddenly have a $300 million plant operate.
Speaking of new plants, I saw that you all had a groundbreaking ceremony recently for a new plant in Oregon.
Yeah, that's that one I was telling you. 20,000 square foot new timber cutting line coming in from Italy in a few months. But that's that building that we got to experiment with. We are our own client on that. So I was bound and determined to walk our talk, which is, what do we do with wood? We're a wood place. Oregon is in the middle of timber country. So why would I bring steel from China?
Yeah.
Right? Why would I do that when I can bring glue lambs from the Willamette Valley and the Siuslaw National Forest and the gorgeous lands out here? And a lot of it is really well harvested. It's not all, don't get me wrong, clear cuts still suck. Yeah. They expose microbes in the soil at a much greater rate, letting them off up into the atmosphere. But it's still better than steel. Better.
Correct. So are you pretty excited about all the new policy changes we've seen in building codes when it comes to mass timber construction?
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful lob. I used to say years ago, I would say, hey, if you're saying that you're code compliant, what you're really saying is anything less and you're illegal.
That's true.
Nowadays, though, I'm actually pretty proud of a lot of these codes. They really push, sometimes they push us. We're like, oh, really? I need more in the ceiling of this, whatever. Our own new plant, for instance, we actually had to increase what we planned on, even though it's not going to be an Eden facility. Don't tell that to my coworkers, but it's not going to be particularly heated anyway. So
you just have to manufacture some biochar out of the waste material. That'll heat up the facility.
That's right. We'll have a 55-gallon drum in the corner burning biochar. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about it, honestly. We just poured the slab that I was telling you about, and next week we start raising a glue lamb skeletal structure, and then at about the same time we're going around putting in wall panels. It's good. It's stretching us, both of our, from a design standpoint on some of these right at the edge technologies, but also it's a big investment.
Do you see yourself moving more into or accepting more commercial projects once that facility is up and running?
Yeah, you bet. We're in the midst of building the headquarters for Starfire Lumber, which is a big third generation timber cutting mill down in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and it's going to be a real marquee project. We've done a lot of commercial projects, but we see that as opportunity for us. The commercial world, we can't compete at the lowest level of it, but just my craftsmen don't know how to do a sloppy job. They just don't.
It's just not in their lingo. It's not their skill set to do a sloppy job.
I don't understand it, but you saw Belinda, I'm like, come on, do a crappy job. They just look at me like I'm not talking to them. So there's a lot of commercial work out there that is looking for a higher craft, higher sense of either design and the implementation than they used to. And that's where we fit in.
So what are the future plans do you have for your business, other than this massive expansion?
Yeah, well, so there's that one in Oregon, and then in the New York office, we are actually about to we're buying additional land. We've got plans to repeat new investment in equipment that we're doing on the West Coast back to the East Coast. We're reinventing our HPEZ, high performance made easier, offsite panelization line. And at the same time, we're completely rebuilding our Pioneer Millworks a linear goods line there. So
damn,
we don't
lots
have time
of stuff
to breathe.
Going on. Yeah.
Oof.
So can you tell me
nuts.
A little
Never
bit more?
Boring.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about the high performance panels that you just talked about?
Sure. Offsite construction, offsite panelization is really a hot button in the industry right now. There's good reasons for it. There's labor shortages in certain markets. Up on the side of a mountain, you have a shorter build period. There's some people say there's quality control capacity and issues that are easier. It can be oversold, though. So for us, our DNA is custom and high quality, and that custom offsite panelization is kind of a holy grail. It's hard to really do a good job with. And so we have a certain amount of semi-automated European equipment, but plus high skill and quality people who are really looking at, you know, how do we enclose this building, whether or not it has timbers in it. We're doing both timbered enclosures and non-timbered enclosures. There's slight structural differences in the two, but either way, you got to keep the weather out.
So it's
been a long learning curve. I mean, a long learning curve. We did our first one in 1993, I think I mentioned earlier. But we've been working at it, doing offsite construction all that time, mostly just for our own projects. In fact, pretty much only for our own projects. But one of the things we really want to do is we want to share our knowledge and preach the gospel of high performance and low carbon equivalents. So we created this HPEZ, high performance made easier effort to try to make it easier for that builder who would like to care, but maybe just doesn't have the bandwidth. And there's a lot to learn. Or who wants a special marketing niche because he or she can say, hey, we're high performance. Whereas before all they could say is, hey, we're normal, just like everybody else. So it gives them a little bit of a niche. So we are trying to make high performance easier. It's not easy.
Yeah. So we've seen a lot of modular companies struggling over the last couple of months.
The last couple of years. I mean,
last couple of years.
Naming a successful model, it's, Blue Homes went out and there are
Modulus
some.
Modulus was another one just recently.
Yep. Dwell Homes or something.
Is that because, like you said, it's so difficult. Modular construction is so difficult. It's and there's so much money that has to go into it in order to fully automate the line. Is that something you all identified early on? So you talked about a more hybrid approach. There's certain things that you all need to do on site versus off site.
Yeah. Well said. I think I'm not really the person to talk about why some of these modular went under. I've studied it and I've visited and I get more confused each time. A lot of it has to do with how badly you got to scale up. To make this work, you got to be doing it in the hundreds.
Exactly.
And so to do it in the hundreds means you've got to streamline the design process. And if you streamline the design process, nobody wants to buy your product. So it's really this self-defeating cycle where we've got 60 models and I can't believe you don't want to buy one of them, Mrs. Consumer. So I know that's what happened in Blue Homes. A friend of mine was there at the beginning through the end. And she just said basically they had all these designs and never did they sell one. And so each one was reinventing the wheel.
A unique project, which doesn't work with modular construction, yeah.
It doesn't work well, that's for sure. They just keep going under. So in our case, we went into it with eyes wide open and saying, we know we're not going to be that. We're not going to be doing 200 projects a year. We're going to try to manage our size continue to do what we do, which is sort of the more difficult, the more custom, but realize that we're not going to be able to, you know, compete with, you know, the modular home down the road that is just doing roll-offs and double wides. That's just not in our DNA. I don't disrespect them. I mean, yeah. Particularly the ones who are trying
to tackle that problem, and it's admirable. And I hope we learn from, we're going to see some failures, but I hope we learn from them in the next Katera to come up. We is hopefully successful.
Oh, you know what? It's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but I was a quarterback that day the first time I saw him at the Timber Conference, and said, that is a lot more chutzpah than knowledge. So that was just a drag. And if your client, if your listeners aren't aware, Katera was a multi-billion dollar effort that was going to redefine the whole construction industry as they looked down their nose at centuries and generations of builders and saying we didn't know what we're talking about.
Agreed.
And one day they just shut their doors.
Yeah, I made a video on their company and what happened to them. And I spoke to a couple of people who used to work there. And it seemed like it started off with very genuine, very talented people with genuine intentions, but they got lost in the process. They forgot what their initial goals were, and it turned into just money-making. How can we make as much right now? How can we be fully vertically integrated and produce as much as we possibly can? And they lost those initial values, it seemed like.
Yeah, greed is a funny thing.
Yeah. All right, so it was really great learning about your company, New Energy Works, and the values that you hold dear to you and all your employees as well. I usually end my podcast asking the interview for some advice for a young professional who wants to change our industry the way you have. I mean, like we said earlier, we're not going to change the entire planet. We're not going to revamp the entire AEC industry, but we can do our little part in it to build better. So what sort of advice would you have for a young professional?
So, yeah, I can actually give tons of advice because I've done everything wrong at least 20 times. And after you've done something wrong 20 times, you get the hang of it, you know, at least doing it wrong part. But here's what I would say, and if I was a young professional again, I wouldn't listen to me either. But here's what I would say. Find yourself a group, like a networking group, who are mission aligned. So, for instance, in the Northeast, there's the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. Join their Building Energy Bottom Lines networking group. They rock. I've been involved in that 10 years. I never miss a meeting. I've just started one in the Pacific Northwest. We're calling it Building Forward Collaborative. We've had our first meeting. The first group is full, but I'm starting to develop a second group of 10. These are mission-driven people like yourself, where you can share information, share knowledge, share shoulders to cry on. And that really is very helpful because you have to be a good business person as much as a good builder. And so that's the key. Now, the second part is, and then I think we all have to wrap it up. The second part is don't be too greedy. Share the knowledge. Over-communicate to your people. Over-communicate to your coworkers. They want to know what's going on. Otherwise, they'll just fill it in with imagination and bad dreams. So over-communicate. We do a day of business every year where we shut down the whole company and we share our books, we share our vision, we share our budget, we share how we did last year, how we do next year, and plus we share details and projects and birthdays and weddings. Then in the evening we bring in some food trucks, drink beer, and throw axes. You know, share. That's really what I would say. People want to be part of something bigger than themselves. Don't call it a company, call it a community.
That's wonderful, Jonathan. Thank you again for sharing all that information with us and telling us a little bit more about you, telling us about your company. I'm going to link your website and your contact info in the description if people want to reach out to you to learn more about the types of buildings that you all construct. And I'm looking forward to the new factory that's going to open up. Is it this year or next year in Oregon?
Oh, it's quite this year.
This year, okay.
Yeah, my board will kick me off if I don't.
Okay, so I'm looking forward to news about that. Thanks again, Jonathan.
Thanks, Belinda. Talk soon.
See ya.